Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the gods, heroes, monsters, and other mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. As you can hear, my voice is still not in perfect shape, so this might be a little bit of a shorter episode today. We'll see how it goes. In today's episode, we've got a couple of interesting and connected figures from Indian mythology, so let's get started. First up, we have the Maruts, or Marutas, and they are sort of storm spirits or deities. There are a couple of different myths about their origin. One is that they are the children of Rudra, who we'll talk about a little bit later on, and they're sometimes just called Rudras. And in other versions, they're somebody else's kids, but they are typically the like followers or attendants of Indra. They're basically Indra's posse. They're sort of like little mini Indras in that they're rowdy storm warriors. If Indra represents a figure from the kind of traditional warrior aristocracy, you would expect like the ideal such figure to have a kind of retinue. You know, one of the roles that such a leader is supposed to have is to be followed by a group of young warriors and to provide for them. So the Marutas kind of fill that role for Indra. In this version, so in Deities and Demigods, we're told that they are armed with broadswords and that, or with a variety of weapons, often broadswords, and that they can fly. While they can fly in the myths and art where they appear, it's more often that they have magic chariots, often chariots that are actually made from clouds or golden chariots. And among the weapons that they're armed with are axes that they use to cut open clouds to let the rain out. And also, of course, like other storm deities, they are sometimes seen armed with thunderbolts, which I think is a little bit more characterful, you know. I mean, I understand that the way the system works is that if you're going to introduce this magical flying chariot, you want to be a little concerned, especially if you give it to a lesser deity, because, you know, the PCs are going to steal it. But I feel like you just can't do Vedic and other early Indian mythology without having chariots. Like, think about the chariot scene in the Mahabharata. Another version of the myth of the origin of the Marutas says that their mother wanted to have a son so powerful that he could defeat Indra. And in order to do this, she had to fulfill like this big set of restrictions while she was pregnant. Like, she had to do all these prayers every day, and she had to not do this and not go there and sleep with her head to the west and so on. And so hearing about this, Indra set out to kind of break the taboo so that the son would not be born this powerful deity who could overthrow him. And he basically wound up dividing that deity's power among a bunch of sons. So, you know, instead of having one son, she wound up having 49 sons, which must have been an awkward delivery to, and those sons of the Marutas. And so, you know, in that version of the story, they're very explicitly kind of lesser Indras. Now, I said there were 49 of them, but that's just one version of the story. There are lots of different accounts of the Marutas, and in some, there are 11 or 33 or 180 or whatever. It's not consistent. In a fantasy pantheon, it's nice to have, you know, messengers or agents for the divine. And I feel like the Marutas are a pretty good example of that for this one, particularly in a Vedic world where Indra is the top dog. If you don't want Indra to be like appearing with messages, and you don't necessarily even think that, you know, the PCs are at the level of importance where they could get a visit from Agni, then, you know, sending a Maruta to express Indra's approval or displeasure probably makes sense. And they fulfill a social role that I think is also like recognizable and, you know, if PCs aren't familiar with it, can help explain something about the kind of cultural hierarchy to them. So the idea that, you know, a leader will have this retinue, you know, these young warriors around him, I think is something you can use the Marutas to convey. Next up, we have Ratri. Ratri is the goddess of the night, and she is depicted here as, among other things, a protector and patron of thieves. I don't think that that is accurate at all. Ratri is the goddess of the night. She's actually, you know, interestingly, In Vedic sources, she appears a comparatively small number of times. However, the main hymn that she appears in, Ratri Suktam, the hymn to the night or ode to the night, is a very famous one. And, if you want to like go on YouTube and just search for Ratri Suktam, you can find, videos of people reciting it. And those can be either in like a traditional devotional context or even kind of as like a pop song. Like there are popular versions of the Ratri Suktam. So I'm reading this translation of Ratri Sukta. It is mostly about the idea that the darkness that Ratri represents, or the night, is a darkness that one must pass through to reach the light of self-realization. So as with a lot of the other deities that we've covered, there is like a humanized narrative version of the deity and also this symbolic spiritual interpretation. Anyway, here's their translation of Ratri Suktam. Om. The goddess Ratri approaching illumines every direction with her eyes. She has put on all her glories. The immortal goddess has filled the world's breadth, heights, and depths with her light. She drives away the darkness. The approaching goddess follows upon her sister, Usha, at whose coming the darkness likewise departs. Now she is upon us. At her coming we go to rest, as birds to their nest in a tree. The villagers have gone to rest, and so too all the creatures that walk or fly, even the ravenous hawks. Ward off the she-wolf and the wolf, ward off the thief, O wave of darkness, and be easy for us to pass through. For now the palpable blackness crushes down upon me. O dawn, collect it dutifully. As you would accept a precious herd of cattle, O daughter of heaven, O night, accept this hymn, offered as if to a conqueror. So that's from the Rig Veda 10.127, and the translation is by Devadatta Kali in a collection called In Praise of the Goddess. So as we can see, this goddess of the night is someone who actually protects people from the dangers of the night rather than embodying them. Again, we see this idea that the social relationship with a concept that a deity embodies is more important than some kind of like abstract. So, Agni is a social fire in many ways, right? One of his roles as messenger of the gods is because things are burnt in fire to send them to the realm of the divine. In the same way, the social meanings of night, that it's a time for rest after work, for example, make Ratri a welcome deity, but also one who protects from the hazards that come at nighttime. So not an embodiment of what night means abstractly, but of what night means to people. I think there's a desire to have a god of thieves. So an example would be taking the, somewhat scoundrelly but basically good-hearted hero Ne Zha and turning him into a god of thieves in the Chinese mythology section. Ne Zha is more broadly a god of insofar as he's a god, he's an adventurer. Like, he's a bit of a rascal, but he's certainly not a thief, or a patron of thieves anyway, but maybe of slightly roguish characters like gamblers. But here we run into the problem of the conflict between what D&D makes fundamental to its structure and what societies make fundamental to the structure, right? There are societies that have gods of thieves. Mercury is the most obvious example, but among being a god of a lot of other things. But it's not like having a sun god or a moon god, it's not one of those things that you find everywhere. But Ward and, to whatever extent, Kuntz are struggling with the fact that it's so important in the game that, that maybe they need to sort of take something that fits a little bit and try to make it fit as best they can. I do like the idea of this goddess who watches over humanity at night, and I do like the idea of maybe her being particularly popular among the relatively rare percentage of the population who work at night. Because for most people, the night is the end of work. She's a goddess of the return home. It says, we go to rest like birds going to their nests in trees. So she's actually kind of a benevolent, protective figure. And finally, we're going to return to a familiar theme with another storm god, Rudra. His name might come from a word meaning wild or fierce, might come from a word meaning red. A lot of places will tell you confidently, but my understanding is that the etymology remains debated. Rudra is a figure who appears in the Rig Veda, and then as the Vedic faith develops into Hinduism, he becomes associated with Shiva, such that he is just kind of an aspect of Shiva. And in Hinduism, he is said to have been created when one of the aspects of Shiva, Brahma, became so angry that his anger manifested, like actually came out of his head, in the form of Rudra. As you might expect from someone who has that origin, and whose name might mean, you know, howler, Rudra is fierce and aggressive. He's typically depicted with arrows. One of his epithets is armed with a fistful of arrows. And he is, in addition to being a storm god, he's a plague god. So he may be kind of presides over disasters and misfortunes. You might say that he represents that type of nature in its wrathful aspect. Now, like plague gods in many cultures, he's also responsible for protecting people from plague or healing people from plague. One of the hymns to him calls him, like, you know, the greatest physician. Over time, Rudra kind of got blended into nature gods as a whole and became a more benevolent figure. Not to say that he doesn't have that aspect to begin with, but his role as a deliverer of disaster kind of got toned down. And he went from being a pretty scary character to someone who was not all bad to someone who was mostly pretty good. At least that's the impression that I get of the history. He's not as important in the Rig Veda. So, for example, there's four or five hymns devoted to Rudra in the Rig Veda compared to, you know, 250 for Indra or 200 for Agni. Indeed, even the Marutas get nearly 40. So he's a known figure, but not a super important one in the Vedic cosmology. In addition to his bow, Rudra also carries a type of axe that is typically associated with hunting. So he became like a patron of hunters, as someone associated with kind of nature and the wild and animals. He's sometimes depicted with an antelope. I think he makes kind of an ideal patron for rangers. So here are some examples from Sri Rudram, which is another prayer or hymn to Rudra, asking him to stay his wrathful hand, I guess, right? To transform himself into a peaceful form and give up his angry form. And this is, of course, sometimes interpreted as, you know, that same conflict that is inside all of us. So these are two examples of prayers to Rudra that come from this source. I think they're from this source. Anyway, they're at least being quoted in a discussion about it. I don't read Sanskrit. We salute and respect him who is naturally scented, him who looks after his devotees with mercy, and him who has three eyes, and pray and request to move us away from the catch of death, like the cucumber separated from its stalk, and firmly put us in the path of salvation. So there he sounds pretty benevolent. This mantra is a little bit more balanced between Rudra's two possible forms. Salutations to you, God, who is the Lord of the universe, who is the greatest among gods, who has three eyes, who destroyed the three cities, who is master of the three fires, who is the Rudra who burns the world, who has a blue neck, who won over the god of death, who is lord of everything, who is ever peaceful, and who is the greatest god with goodness. Salutations again. And so again, in the, you know, having a spiritual interpretation, well, they're all spiritual, but you know what I mean, having a more symbolic interpretation of Rudra, he is, in one of these prayers, he's asked to turn his weapons not against his devotees, but against their sins, you know, so to hunt and destroy the sins that they have committed or that they might commit, and thus purify them and put them, as the first one says, on the path to salvation. I am sure there's a good reason why he has a blue neck, but I don't know what it is. Like I said, I think he makes a good patron for rangers, and indeed for kind of older or newer portrayals of rangers, because like if you look at, the way Rangers have developed in 5th edition. Rangers have kind of, in this edition, been a class that doesn't really have a comfortable home. There hasn't been a specific thing that the class does. They're kind of a weird compromise between the combat ability of a fighter, the stealth and mobility of a rogue, and the natural world knowledge of a druid, except that neither druids nor rangers really know that much about the natural world, because in 5th edition, nature runs off intelligence, a stat that neither of those classes typically have. But never mind. The result, however, has been that some of the new kind of material for rangers has been quite creative in trying to find what it is that a ranger does. So the sort of hunter symbol has created things like the Gloomstalker. I mean, whether you're a fan of the Gloomstalker or not, the idea that a ranger is a sort of guerrilla fighter rather than hunter and woodsman is an interesting one, as is the idea of the ranger as a kind of manhunter. And I think that the idea of like seeking out and destroying evil fits that kind of sort of a fighter, sort of an investigator role. Never mind that Rudra is also, you know, a nature deity with natural connotations. So I like the idea of a Rudra-like deity who appeals particularly to rangers. And if, you know, that role is a little confusing in some ways, well, at present, so is being a ranger. I'm not bitter or anything, you understand. I play a ranger and I have a fantastic time playing a ranger. So anyway, yeah, that is about all the Indian mythology that we have time for today. I do think it's a good example of how more complex myths are kind of getting hammered into round holes in deities and demigods, and I think that's a shame. And I think that in many cases, if you go back to the original sources, even if you, you know, just approach them from a reading perspective rather than a devotional one, like even if you're just, you know, moved by the poetry, you know, rather than the spiritual meaning of it, you can find a lot more interesting inspiration. I saw a depiction of various pantheons that someone had done artwork of as part of like some Facebook group that I'm in, and it was very clearly based on deities and demigods. Like, you know, here's a group of Indian deities that includes Ratri but not Ganesh. Okay, I know where this came from. I feel like sometimes when I'm reading this book, I feel like it's a little bit like one of those things where, like, when you're reading what your parents consider to be like trashy genre fiction when you're a kid, and someone says like, oh, well, at least they're reading. I mean, I think that's an unfair thing to say in a lot of cases, and probably I'm being unfair too, but I do think that one of the most important things that a book like Deities and Demigods can do is get people interested in the myths and legends that inspired it. And in that sense, it's certainly working. All right. In our next episode, guess what? We're going to continue our journey through the Indian mythos section of Deities and Demigods. We're going to take a look at, among other things, the sun god. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.